Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, welcome everybody to the final Monday evening Contemporary Issues. So this is our end of our spring semester. Bev is sad. She is dabbing at her eyes. We anticipate that we will be back in person on Sunday mornings come fall. I don't expect there to be a good reason for us not to be in person on Sunday mornings back at our 9 o'clock time. So my gratitude to those of you who have stuck with us all the way through this year for keeping this class alive. So thank
you. Our gratitude to you, Nathan. Yeah. This has been an amazing season for me, learning so much about things I never even thought about learning. So thank you. Big thank you. Great thank you.
Do we get a sticker? I need a sticker. A ribbon.
What?
Participation trophy.
A completion trophy, right?
Yeah. Mary's ready.
Oh, yeah, Mary's got a sticker.
That a girl.
That's right. You have to show your ID on the way into Methodist, yeah, so they can give you a sticker.
I don't anymore, just the first time. But I have to turn my sticker back in. I stuck out Saturday with it still on. I didn't know.
Oh, yeah. And then they hunt you down.
That's a long way to go.
That's right. Yeah, if you cross a state line with the sticker on, then that's a federal crime.
Oh.
No. So 8 o'clock, the FBI is coming for Mary. That's what's going on.
I gotcha.
Well, this evening, I want to give us a little bit of check-in on climate change here in Iowa. So we have had other conversations here and there about climate change, and we have some climate change experts with us as well in Marilyn Johnson and Kent Myers. We've talked about it primarily on kind of the global scale, which is where it's happening on a global scale. So this is not a localized phenomenon, but its effects are very localized. So we have also talked about, when we have checked in with our neighbors in San Ysidro, we hear what climate change is doing to the local climate in El Salvador, and changing the patterns of rainfall and really, contributing to really crisis level food shortages in El Salvador. So we see that, we see impacts in coastal areas, and here we sit in a lovely temperate area, far, far from the coasts. So you could find yourself imagining that maybe climate change is a far away kind of issue, but we are also now seeing some early effects of climate change right here in the Midwest. So I'm gonna begin by handing it over to WOI-TV meteorologist Brandon Lawrence, who is joining us live via Time Machine from April 22nd of this year. He did a small feature on, climate change is happening for Earth Day. So I'm gonna hand this over to Brandon Lawrence, and then we will come back and talk about specifically what we are seeing here in Iowa. So there is a very brief glance at how climate change is already happening here in Iowa, not some faraway thing, but taking place right here in our own immediate climate. The Iowa DNR has a longer list of climate impacts that we know are on their way, and are many of these are happening already. So increased precipitation, and especially extreme precipitation. Longer dry spells and then really intense periods of rain that lead to flooding. And overall, 8% more precipitation per year from 1873 to 2008. So an overall increase there. Higher temperatures. So that was, Brandon showed us the graph of temperatures. And we know that temperatures can change by 60 degrees in a given day. But overall, even just that 2.5 degree change in temperature, that's a bigger change than the global temperature change. So we are catching more of that heat than the globe on average. Long-term winter temperatures have increased 6 times more than summer temperatures. So the winters, even though we'll have those deep cold snaps, the overall winter temperatures are not as cold. And it's not cooling off as much at night either. So both of those, the sort of this residual heat, both season long and day by day. And it's more humid than it was before, which in turn fuels thunderstorms. So that's where some of that more intense summer precipitation comes in. From an agricultural perspective, last time I checked, we are still by square mile an agricultural state. Those extremes are more important than the averages in terms of crop and livestock productivity. So you can have a really great growing season until early August, and then you flatten all the corn and it gets real bad real fast. Just a long, hot, dry spell can do the same. The higher amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere makes plants grow faster and send out a whole bunch more pollen, and that's great, but it also tends to lower the nutritional quality of those plants. And then at some point, it gets too hot for that accelerated growth too. The cycles of the season, when things leaf and flower, when the birds arrive, when and where animals go, those are obviously temperature dependent, and over a long span, those are, leaves and flowers are coming sooner in the spring, birds are arriving earlier in the spring. Animals are moving farther north than they had been in the past as they are adjusting to even just that, again, 2.5 degree average change. As temperatures rise, you also get more of the air pollutants, the fine particles and ozone stick around more in the higher temperatures. Infectious diseases transmitted by insects, you get more insects. That's not to say that we need to kill the insects, right? We have that problem as well with, losing our pollinators, but we get, more of the insects that we don't want. So these are all sort of present effects of climate change that are already beginning here in Iowa. That we're seeing even just as we look back a few decades, some of us can look back, in agricultural terms, many decades and see, it's not just the equipment that's different in agriculture today versus before. So there is your brief introduction to climate change as a present reality in Iowa.
Let me speak to agriculture for just a minute, if I may. One reason we don't notice droughts and drownouts so much is that there has been tremendous progress in developing seeds that are resistant to those problems. I can read about it all I want, but when I talk to farmers I know, they say, yeah, they're doing that. And year by year, they change the seeds. The smart farmers are paying much more attention to what Ames tells them. And that's one reason we aren't noticing the problems, that we're keeping ahead of them, but not by being better, just by being more vigilant. Another thing I will tell you from personal experience is that I've been going to ag shows for 40 or 50 years now. And there's always a climatologist or somebody on the panel. Excuse me. There's always a climatologist or somebody, thank you, on the panel. And I would always try to engage them in conversation about what's going to happen. And they would always dodge the question until about 5 years ago. Now they suddenly sound more like Reverend here. They say, it's real, it's coming, we can measure it, you can't deny it anymore. The problem is the farmers may be getting smarter, the meteorologists may be getting smarter, but I'm not sure anybody else is. Talking about it is just great, as far as I'm from where I sit in my easy chair. But it occurs to me that I'm not going to be here forever. And before it all, almost said a bad thing, all gets bad, I'm going to be gone. And I'd like my kids and my kids' kids to have it good, if not better. But most of the people around them don't care. It's easier for me to think, why should I care if the people who actually have skin in the game don't care? And a third of them get up and say it's all phony and we're all communists. I have trouble. I have more trouble caring. And this is the time for y'all to talk me out of that. And I'm not saying I'm going to go out and set fire to forests, but I'm not as passionate about climate as I used to be.
Now, John, don't set fire to the forests. They are important carbon sinks. We need controlled burns for the health of the forests so they can continue drawing carbon in, but don't burn them down.
Okay, that'll be my contribution. I won't go out and burn any forests down today.
Bingo.
Columbia University mentioned, or has done a county by county survey across the country. In the case of Iowa, they believe about 57 to 60% of Iowans believe in climate change, but only 35% of those, or 40, believe it will affect them personally. And I think that's the rub, is how does it affect me personally? And I've seen in businesses past, when I've worked with trying to turn a company around, people tend to deny something's going to happen if it affects them, because they just don't want to realize how much difficulty they're in. And I think you're seeing some of that. And you've already seen in 2019, we had the massive floods. And the University of Iowa, for example, has already talked about how what they call the Midwest garden hose, Midwest hose effect generated a lot of that flooding. And what that is with the cold front from the north and all the moisture coming up from the Gulf, it's more dramatic now. And it's creating more greater situations for more rain, and it's more concentrated rain. We may not get any less rain, but it's going to be heavier when it does happen. Another effect you're seeing in Iowa is the department at DOT is trying to design, when they redo a bridge, where it's stronger so it can take flooding better, easier, so it's not washed out as well. So you're seeing some of that. And in 2020, you did see a pretty strong, pretty bad drought in the western part of the state that affected agriculture. And they're predicting this year, once these rains stop for this month, we'll go back into a drought situation again. And again, back to the University of Columbia, they're projecting out over a longer period of time that the average, I think we have about 33 days that average over 90 degrees in the summer. And they're expecting that to go up dramatically. And that will affect corn yields because once it hits that 90 to 100 degree temperature, it starts suppressing growth or stunning growth, I'll say it that way. And the corn will tend to be more starchier from what I read. Hmm. I you know, these are the things that you're starting to see right now. The derecho last year, they're starting to realize they have to plant shorter, smaller crops. So when a big wind comes along, the smaller corn did better than the taller corn. Hmm. Just get into little things like that.
So some of the things that Kent's describing are this shift from trying to prevent climate change from happening some decades in the future to managing the, you know, absorbing kind of the building in resiliency to climate change as it is happening now, which is a fairly recent shift in some of these, you know, some of this approach to climate change that we're seeing. We're not just gonna stop this thing from happening, but rather it's coming and it's here. And what are we gonna do to keep bridges standing and keep corn growing? And you know, some of the technological advances in corn production, you know, some of that has been for taller and taller and taller corn, right? You know, you remember the old line about knee high by the 4th of July, and now it's knee high by like Memorial Day. And it's taller than John, which is not remarkable, but it's taller than on any of the rest of us as well. You know, and typically, you know, typically it's up to our shoulders and our head by the 4th of July when knee high used to be great, which, you know, was helpful for yields under a certain sort of, under a certain set of climate conditions. You know, you could harvest it more efficiently with your combines and all the, you know, there were a lot of pieces that was actually beneficial for, and now it's not so much anymore. And so how do we, you know, how do we swing into, you know, continuing to grow food in a climate that's not as friendly to growing nutritious food, or keep our infrastructure standing when floods are bigger and more frequent? Beth.
Well, I'm thinking about the, you know, with as fast as the scientists came up with a vaccine for COVID, I'm thinking, okay, so if the corn doesn't need to be so tall due to derechos, we want it to be shorter, more compact perhaps, and they're probably doing something with the fertilizers or the ground when they till, when they do their recreational tilling in the spring. Do you think that maybe they would also be then working into the dirt things that will hold water better? They make it now for plants, I mean, for house plants, that it'll keep a plant wet for a month if you need to. They could do that in the corn, but I like the idea of the shorter corn. But now we're talking, so can a John Deere adjust to that, or does that also affect the industry of what do you call it, when you reap the crop, when you bring the crop in? I mean, are they going to be able to mow down shorter corn? Is it going to do the same?
Now, so I guess so. I mean, that's already a production.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, they've already compared during the derecho. They found crops that had, or fields that had shorter corn did better than the fields that had taller corn. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, that's what raised my question. Have they adapted the John Deere's and the yellow ones and the red ones, whatever they are?
That, so I'll say yes.
Okay.
You should all be happy to know that that SUI, so I see I'm dating myself, Iowa State.
Oh.
And Purdue and Missouri and Michigan State and a couple of the other leading ag land grant colleges are years ahead of us on this stuff. And if I pick up a magazine, I'm going to read all about that. Tillage is completely changed from when I was a kid. Hardly anybody does a moldboard tillage.
Well, they're anymore. Saving dirt, right? They leave it. They leave
that too.
Crop
that to too, but what they mix in to hold water, and all the things you're mentioning are all being done, but there's only so much they can do. So that's why I was saying we're kind of holding it off and pretending it isn't there, but it's still there. We're doing things that they invented. Some of you are familiar with the Wallaces. Stuff the Wallaces invented around 1900 are now being done routinely. Where my dad spent his whole production career preaching about that stuff in terms of land stewardship. He was a very good Presbyterian and paid a lot of attention to stewardship. I heard about that all the time. And he was right. And there are a few more people paying attention, but I'm afraid there are a lot more saying, oh, the universities are going to keep up with this just like they got us out of COVID in a year. Ain't so. Ain't going to happen.
Bruce.
Every day, we have the technology to see around the world the disasters from the melting of the glaciers to the burning of the forest, to the tornadoes, the floods. And I mean, it's in our face every day. So I can't believe there are people out there that are deniers of climate change. It's just incredible. All of the evidence that's right in our face.
Well, I think it was interesting, you know, Kent cited the survey, and it was not that people are saying climate change isn't happening, but they're saying it's not going to affect me, which is, it's the backside of having managed things fairly well so far. You know, whether we were directly managing, okay, we're going to, you know, climate change is happening and we have this particular effect, and so we need to be able to increase the water retention of the soil, or if we did that for some other reason, but it has also improved our climate resiliency, we can get ourselves convinced that this is not in fact going to affect us, and at the same time these effects are already taking place. Yeah, so it's easy to convince ourselves that what we know is true is not. Russ.
Yes, saying that it's not going to affect us is not really true. It is affecting us now. floods, washout floods in the southeast, terrible fires in the west. Droughts in Iowa, and it's going to get worse if we don't get something done about it.
Yeah, on a more local level, I just read the news a couple weeks ago that if we have a very severe drought in central Iowa, even though we've got two rivers, the Raccoon and the Des Moines, that we could be rationing water. And I thought, it had never really occurred to me, because we've got two rivers and I thought we're safe. Well, that's not necessarily the case, and we may have to be cutting down on our water usage.
Well, part of the problem with the water situation is there's so much nitrogen going into the water from runoff from the fields that it's expensive to what I want to say, clean it, make it drinkable.
Purify.
And nitrogen is also a problem with global climate change, because it's one of the leading causes to it. So you've got a compound issue going on there. You got a climate change issue, and then you got a pollution issue dealing with the streams and the rivers. So, and when you clean up one, you'll probably be cleaning up the other. Agriculture, there's a lot of people, for example, that profess to use, they should be using no-till farming, so you don't have the erosion that happens with just plowing in general. The other part that plays into it was trying to set up buffers between the rivers, and that gets into trying to find ways to keep the nitrogen from running off. One of the things Iowa's got a problem with is they've been irrigating or tiling their fields since about 1890, and they continue to do that. So the water just runs off that much faster. So when the nitrogen's put on, about half the nitrogen doesn't even make it into the field. It just runs off with the first rain and the of the tiling. Corn cannot stand just wet, soggy fields. I found it an interesting note that Iowa was settled from south to north because all the wetter fields, the wetlands were in the northern part of the state. And because of that, it was the last to be settled. So it's an interesting thing. But going back to someone else's point, no-till, trying to find a way to utilize the nitrogen better. One thing I saw a demonstration on was Iowa State was working with a biofuel generator where they could take switchgrass and make a biofuel out. And they were building a prototype in Redfield, and they were building a second one in Spokane, Washington. And they actually thought that the one in Spokane would be profitable because it was using the fall down from when they clear cut a forest, there's a lot of waste they got to clean up. And they were taking that off the field and running it through this biofuel generator, making fuels. And they didn't think they'd be profitable in the Iowa one because they're still dealing with trying to compete with fossil fuels, which is a very cheap fuel source. But going back to my point, there, one of the things that farmers, I think, need to start thinking about is that if they don't come to the table to start to deal with these issues, and as the problem gets worse, a lot of the response will be they'll be forced to do something, and rather than take a proactive approach to solving the problem, it's going to be forced on them. And that's what I hope the farmers would learn, that they need to be proactive in dealing with how they want to manage their farms going forward to deal with these issues, rather than someone from another state coming in, look, we got a major problem, and if you don't want to do anything about it, we'll do it for you.
I find that most farmers are doing exactly that. Now, I don't talk to all farmers, but most of the ones I talk to are saying exactly that, and then saying, we're doing all this work, and all they do is complain about prices. Now, that doesn't mean they're right, but I don't blame them for saying that.
Well, I think, like, one of the things when I was talking about that tall grass or switchgrass, I think you'll see at some point in the time, I think I even saw where Vilsack was talking about doing was start paying the farmers to sequester carbon, because some of this tall grass has got risk systems that go down 10, 12, 15 feet. It helps retain the soil, plus and I think that if they work it right, they could get paid for doing that and then sequestering carbon.
Put the carbon back in. That's
interesting. Matt, I'm done for now, guys. I'll wait till someone else says something.
So what else should the farmers be doing?
Well, I'm not a farmer, so I hate to say what they should be. I'm just telling you things I've read. Because if I try and tell a farmer how to do it, he's going to tell me what to do, too.
Did it have to do with flying?
Tell you where to go.
Yeah. Tell me about flying.
Do you know, I was absolutely amazed. Before we left last week, you could walk across the Des Moines River. I mean, when you Raccoon River. When you would go over the bridge, it was so dry. There was this little trickle going through. Mm. And then it rained all week. Very much, Nathan, what you said, John, what you said, Kent, what you said, that there will be possibly the same amount of rain. It's going to be longer dry spells and the deluges will come, or like they did this past week. I don't know that you call that a deluge, but it is a concentrated time of rain.
What I also noticed about last week was that the rain was concentrated in location.
Oh.
In some ways that I found interesting. That and I'm not certain whether that's a climate change effect or not, but it's one of those sort of, my gut level feels like it's seeing it a little bit more, where the, you know, you'll get sort of rain in one area but not in another area. Mm-hmm. And over, you know, some fairly short distances. So Wednesday, for instance, when I was watching the radar so that we could figure out whether we can have a yard party. You know, we got some sort of, we got wet at the yard party, but not very much. And it, you know, it was very gentle and kind of through the whole time. Not very far west of the church building, it was raining pretty constantly the entire day. And so trying to just think about, so, you know, we've got all this water now coming down through the Raccoon River watershed, that none of it landed here. Or some of it landed here, right? But not very much of it landed in West Des Moines. You know, more of it landed in Van Meter. You know, not very far away, but still, it was a difference in terms of where the, you know, the water landed here. And, you know, it's good for the watersheds and the rivers, but you can't grow corn with water that fell somewhere else. At least, you know, east of the Missouri, that's really hard to do. West of the Missouri, they irrigate a lot. That's a totally different approach to agriculture. But in an area where we don't irrigate, you know, water that falls west of us doesn't do the crops a lot of good. It does our source of drinking water a lot of good, which is, you know, we need that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's an interesting, subject for sure. The one thing that I'd like to share with the group I found interesting, I sent Marilyn a link to it, but if you Google something called En-ROADS, En-ROAD, you'll get to a website that shows a program that was developed by MIT and then Climate Energy Interactive. And there's a lot of variables you can play with to see how that would affect the climate. It's an interactive module. And for example, if you electrified all your cars, how much difference would that make going forward? And a lot of people think that's going to be a big change. But the problem comes, cars take 10 to 12 years to rotate out the old fleet to the new fleet. So going all electric with cars is not as big a saver as you think. And it had other things like, if you started developing more renewable energy like wind and solar, you could play with that part of the slide, and it'll kind of tell you how that will affect the temperature going forward. I just found that interesting, and it also shows you how difficult this subject is. You know, man has affected climate once already, and that was the ozone layer, the ozone hole. And under Reagan, we had the Montreal protocols, and they changed this carbon fluorides out of the air conditioners and everything. And they're projecting now that by 2050, it will be sealed. It will be closed up again. And if we hadn't done something like that, you'd be getting sunburned in about 10 minutes walking outside. So if you hadn't tried to solve that problem, that was a simple problem compared to what you're seeing with the climate change. So if someone tells you man can't affect climate change, telling about the ozone layer.
So it seems that when we talk about, you know, when we talk about these, you know, resiliency strategies and mitigation strategies, you know, how do we actually, you know, draw down the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, and how do we, you know, how do we respond to the damage that is already done? You know, we talk about the, you know, for instance, it would be fantastic to, you know, to pay Iowa farmers to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what plants do, right? Plants pull carbon out of the atmosphere and they stick it somewhere. And those prairie plants particularly are great at pulling carbon out of the atmosphere and sticking it way down in really deep roots because the above ground part of the plant tends to be, you know, tends to die off and regrow each year. But the way that it does that is by stocking away all of its carbon down under the ground rather than above the ground like trees do. Trees have roots too. That's an oversimplification. But partly, you know, if we're talking about, hey, it's gonna, you know, it, last time I checked, it costs money to pay somebody to do something, right? So if we say, hey, we, you know, we're gonna find a way to incentivize the drawdown of carbon, or we're going to, you know, we're going to figure out a way to deal with the fact that, what, you know, 90% of the cars that are on the road today are gonna be on the road next year too. And so that change is going to be very slow in terms of, you know, and internal combustion cars are things that most of their carbon footprints happens after you build them, as compared to some other, you know, there are other machines that, you know, building it is when you really put the energy in, and then once it's there, it's worth keeping running. So that's going to cost something. And so how do we, you know, how do we manage those costs and bear those costs in a way that does not, you know, that does not also deprive the people who don't have enough of what they need? You know, how do we manage the fact that, that, you know, growing corn is great and, you know, is a good way to feed a bunch of people. It's also a way to produce, you know, transportation fuel that is better for the earth than digging things up out of the ground. You know, how do we do that in a world where people also need to eat corn and poor people need to eat corn? So how do we, you know, these are really interrelated problems, and so the resiliency pieces have to be interrelated too. How do we, you know, how do we do something that, you know, biofuels will continue having sort of upward pressure on the price of corn when people around the world have difficulty affording corn at a certain price point? And so how do we manage both of those pieces, John, and then Beth?
I want to answer your question, Nathan, mostly by referring it to Kent. Kent, you're involved with Interfaith Power and Light, right?
I've been to some of the meetings. I'm actually with a CCL, Citizens Climate Lobbyist, where I spend most of my time.
Fine, but you're still involved with such things.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the trick is to convince people again of stewardship of God's earth and getting from having enough water to water my lawn or having my cornflakes at a reasonable price is a long ways from saying we've got to do this together. So I was going to ask Kent whether the outfits he worked with have any plan for convincing people to, as a group, to see the problem globally.
Yeah, if you look at that En-ROADS model I was just referring to earlier, the biggest thing that has an effect on changing things going forward is what they call the carbon pricing tax, and some people will sell you carbon pricing and trade. But basically, they were going to price that what they call the negative effects of carbon and price it into the product. So you start showing the true reflection on the price of fuel on the population, like gas would no longer be as cheap. So they're proposing carbon tax, basically, or cap and trade. That's what I wanted to say earlier. That would, in that model I was telling you about, that has the biggest impact of any of the options you can play with. There's, I think I saw somewhere now that they're arguing about in the committee, what do you do with the tax? Some people propose giving it a tax credit back to the poor, basically, to offset the additional costs that they would have to bear. Others are saying use that tax to pay for improved infrastructure dealing with the global climate change. And that's all being discussed right now. I don't know. I've watched this for a couple of years, and I don't know how close they are actually to passing something. I'm really kind of negative on that. But in answer to your question, the best impact on that would be some type of carbon tax, because this problem is so massive, you can't just isolate one piece or another piece. You have to basically find a way for the economy to drive the change.
And what is your organization doing? I mean,
we're doing presentations. I'm on a committee now trying to get out presentations to 99 counties. We've been going out on Zoom, and there's another presentation coming up July 8th. And anyone that wants to sit in on that, I'll send them the Zoom link, because we had to do it virtually. But the carbon tax is what they're proposing. And looking at that En-ROADS model that's put out by MIT, that's basically the answer.
And they're lobbying?
They're lobbying the senators, but the senators and the congressmen aren't going to do anything until their constituents push them to. Senators are not leading, they're following. And it's not just
our senators. Somebody stuffs their back pocket.
What's that?
I said, until someone stuffs their back pocket with money, then they will move.
Yeah. Well, that until the farmers say they're going to vote for someone else if they don't do it. And down areas like Oklahoma and Texas, where you're in a fossil fuel world, they deny climate change yet. But a carbon tax, basically. I don't know if that's where you're heading, Nathan, but that's what it sounded like to me.
Yeah, I come to this conversation without answers, but some way of changing the market around climate change seems really important, because we can move all the attitudes we want to move, but if farmers can only earn their living doing certain kinds of farming, or if I can only get around on certain kinds of fuel, boy, it's really hard to change my behavior, no matter how I feel about it.
Right, so, and that's where the carbon pricing prices it into the product. Start making shifts, and that's where the economy starts driving it. There's a lot of private entrepreneurs that are actually doing a lot of development research in this area. Not a lot, but other people. Starting to do that, not just Iowa State.
Yeah. All right, Bev, and then Bruce.
Oops, sorry, honey.
Oh, you cut me off.
she was already in line.
And this is just the vision that I have. We are all trying, a small group, we are trying to understand this, and we are trying to live it. Yet, with a tin can, a nickel back, the issue is we are 3 million people in our state. Chicago Metro has 9 million and they don't recycle cans. Now, do you think they're going to start thinking about plastics? Do you think they're going to start thinking about what is happening? And we are surrounded by St. Louis, by Omaha, by Chicago, by Minneapolis and Kansas City. Do we really have a chance to make a difference?
There's a book I'm reading out right now that Bill Gates put out, and he just put it out in the last 30 days. It's called How to Avoid the Climate a climate disaster. And he touches on a lot of that. It's one of the better ones I've read recently. I would suggest you kind of read that.
Okay, thank you. How to avoid a climate disaster. Yeah, talk to Cook County, Illinois, and find out if they'll move.
Yeah, I'm not getting any endorsements from, you know, Bill Gates isn't paying me anything for this endorsement.
You figured darn it. Darn.
There's another good book. Bruce, you like the military. There's one on how climate change will affect the military. And as a side note, I know two climatologists. One of them works at the University of Colorado, and a lot of her money comes from the DOD, Department of Defense, and the military. She advises the military on how climate change is going to affect the military. And I can go into a lot of detail about that because I found that was a fascinating book to read.
You just made Bill Gates richer by buying his book. So,
yeah. Well, he lost $50 million on a biofuel project, so I don't think I've made up for it yet.
And he has to split it with his ex-wife.
He's going to split it with his wife, yeah. I was going to say the COVID had an interesting effect. People didn't get out in their cars, didn't go to work. A lot of people stayed home. The air was cleaner over Los Angeles. And it was kind of refreshing to know that all of a sudden there's a big impetus to make electric cars. Just bang, here we are. Listen, we need to make more electric cars.
But they're taking up, they create more issues.
Well, sure. Another thing that I'm surprised that you didn't mention, what are we going to do with China? Because China's in total the leading producer of the pollutants that are making up the climate change. And my one answer, I would say, you know, if you don't do anything, we'll all just go down the toilet together. But at least we got to try and lead and put pressure on them to do it. And they also have some incentive to do it. I've seen the pollution in Beijing, et cetera. And they have, and believe me, when that water starts rising, as Bill Gates said in an interview, he said the migration coming out of Syria just looked like a prelude to what's going to happen. You think your problems down the border are bad now, wait till El Salvador and Honduras get a little drier, and they'll be a lot more headed north.
But I benefited
quietly. They will try and find a salvation somewhere.
I benefited from the COVID. I was getting 3 or 4 weeks per gallon of gas.
Did you see some of those before and after pictures? Like I saw one in Paris where
it was empty.
Fog, yeah. Oh. And then during COVID, it was clear.
Yeah.
And I think it was interesting that we ended up with this kind of natural experiment in a sort of a wholesale change of the lived economy, kind of the economy at a consumer level, where we stopped driving and we stopped flying and we stopped a lot of these places where we in our sort of immediate consumption decisions create immediate pollution, and we saw smog get better, and we saw overall they were saying, particularly in the early weeks of the global phase of the pandemic, to the extent that they can measure immediate carbon footprints, carbon emissions went down considerably during that time. So they said, this is in fact possible. Let's also remember how much cost there was to doing that. You know, how much we lost in the process of that extended period of shutdown. But it raises interesting questions. Bev, you pointed out that electric cars are fantastic, and they come with their own costs.
Yeah.
And not just that you have to pay Elon Musk to get them, but...
keep paying him my own stock.
but that the production process is a, I don't know exactly where the, you know, where the trade-offs and balances are, or, you know, how much room to improve in that process there is.
Well, plus installing the plug in every house.
Right. Yeah. and that electricity has to come from somewhere, right? Some of it comes from my roof. But so all of these, you know, all these, you know, it's better consumption, but it still comes with those costs that we haven't entirely sorted out how to address.
Right.
Yeah.
The other part,
this is going to be messy.
You're talking about the immediate problem, but the population is going to continue to grow, which will exacerbate the situation. And when you try and electrify, you're going to have to build in like a 60% increase over the current capacity worldwide because of the urbanization that is going on in the third world nations, modernization. The other part is never mind, I lost my train of thought. But anyway, you've got to build in that growth.
It's backwards. Bye, Marian Russ. Take care. Prayers coming your way. Sorry, Kent. It's just that they have to leave at 8.
I don't have things to say anyway.
No. That's not going to happen. Bye. We're thinking of you.
The nurse said I could stay as long as I want.
Oh, nice.
All right. Okay.
Hey, there you go. Okay. Well, never mind that then.
We'll still pray.
Yeah. Aw. So you take care, though, when it's time for you to go.
Yeah, I do get home so I can get here by 7 in the morning.
Oh, you'll be okay. You want me to call you and wake you up?
No, I'll wake up.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, go when you feel you need to.
Yeah.
Okay.
You were talking about the electric car, but you have to get a clean energy source for it. You're right. Right now, you'll buy an electric car, and you still got to plug it into a fossil fuel plant to charge it. But we need to also move away from the fossil fuels in the electrical system to where it's a pure non-carbon system. That would be a big, that's going to be a part of that electrical car thing.
The negative part of the COVID was we cut down a lot of trees so that we have more toilet paper.
Well, you know, you say that, Bruce, but the trees might be there could be a salvation there a little bit. Concrete uses a lot of carbon dioxide and it's manufacturing stuff. And the trees could be cut down and used in construction, even on 3-4-story buildings. And the carbon dioxide is still being maintained within that structure because it's not rotting. So if you have a managed forest, then you start to cap that. I mean, those are the kinds of thoughts that need to go into this. So when you say trees, it's not just toilet paper.
Who'd have thought?
Look at the cost of lumber. Yeah, cost of lumber is through the roof.
Well, that's a whole other issue, Bruce.
Yeah, trying to find the employees, right?
Well, that and COVID-19 restricted the factories to the safety issues, and they're just now starting to ramp back up.
Warren, I want to hear what you have to say. You always have good things to say, but you usually leave until the very last.
I thought you'd never ask, John.
He's speechless.
Well, I'm taking in what you others are thinking, and that I find valuable to know how many are parallel to my thinking, how many are just a little bit askew, and how many are at crossroads with my thinking. And a couple of things have been mentioned tonight. One, I think Pam mentioned about water. And another one, I forget who it was. Oh, I think we agreed how successful we were in disease control in such a prompt manner on this COVID-19, which I think has really, if there's been anything good come out of this, I think it's the fact that we don't have to have this years and years and years of developing cures for drugs. I want to admit climate change, because 70 years ago, I remember Iowa winters being very different than what they have been the last 15 or 20. I was a kid on a farm doing chores night and day, taking care of livestock. And I mean, it got cold in Iowa. It stayed cold. The snow did not disappear. It was there from November to March. So I'll admit that the winters in Iowa are much less brutal than they were in the 50s when I was a kid working on a farm. Other things that I've thought about, and John, you tipped me here. Years ago, who would have thought about civil unrest being in Des Moines, Iowa, or Washington, D.C.? You know, that was something in those banana republics, maybe in South America or Africa. But, you know, last summer was very troubling to see how we were protecting seriously our own state capital, and later in January of the next year, the nation's capital. Mind-boggling. We'd never would think of that. Water. Let's go back to Pam. You know, here in the Midwest, you know, we're just finally maybe starting to experience what they are experiencing in California, fighting over drinking water or water for the vegetable and the produce. And I think there were some Hunt brothers years ago who tried to get the silver, put a corner, I can't think of the right phrase. Now those fellows are looking at water rights in the U.S. Water is what the caliber of the Hunt brothers are looking for. Food. There again, that used to be about people starving in Calcutta and people starving in some of the African nations. In the last 15 years, I think we've gained on providing food for those that need it in central Iowa, but I am amazed how we have not, even in our own Polk County and central Iowa, really put a big dent in everyone having, on a reliable basis, nutritious food. So when you think about world problems, if a country like the U.S. and if a state like Iowa and a city like West Des Moines has hungry people and homeless people, how do we think we can project global satisfying all these situations globally? And a lot of you know I'm a big buff of World War II history. And I was watching some Ken Burns stuff. But we all remember in our history lessons, World War I was the war to end all wars. Oh, doesn't that sound beautiful? 20 years later, we're right back at it again. And we cannot. I was fortunate enough to go to Israel at a time when they weren't shooting rockets. And I truly love that little country and wish you all could have visited in Israel, but the distances are very, very small. From the Lebanon border at the north to Gaza to the south to Syria and Jordan. I mean, with rockets that we've got, I don't think there's any place in the country of Israel that is truly safe. And as a tourist, there's no way. Like I say, thank goodness I got my trip in when it was peaceful. We cannot solve war. Like I say, 1918, the war to end all wars, didn't happen. So as far, I hate to be throwing disappointment on these discussions, but human nature as it is, I'm not very optimistic, and I truly would like to be. As John mentioned, our kids, our grandkids, you know, just because we have, you know, limited exposure to some of these problems, the inability within the U.S. to solve these problems does not give me much encouragement on the ability to solve these similar, identical problems worldwide.
Warren, I think what you're talking about is the fact that resource management is affecting income disparity in very obvious ways. Those of us that have are continuing to get, and those of us who aren't, who don't have, are losing out because of climate-related factors. That's how I feel.
Well, just one more comment on that, John. We all recognize, like if we go to El Salvador, you got this very wealthy group at the top and very poor majority and no middle class.
And it's getting worse for the lower class and not for the upper class.
Well, there's in the U.S., it wasn't too many centuries or decades ago that you could be in the middle class and only have one parent working. I was fortunate. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. Now, you talk about housing, that's a temporary blip. But we are eliminating or reducing our own numbers of middle class here in the U.S. We're once again going to become like El Salvador. There's going to be this 10% that's got 90% of the assets and the rest of us. The middle class is shrinking in income disparity, as you mentioned. So I guess somebody needs to be the leader, and it would be wonderful if the U.S. could be the leader in this laundry list of problems. But flipping that coin, if the U.S. cannot solve their own problems internally, be it water, food, civil disobedience, income disparity, if we can't get that solved in our own country, it's pretty hard for us to hope someone else is going to lead the world on a successful campaign on any of those four or five topics. So
look at all the people who deny science, deny the the COVID shot. They deny the election. Look at all the people who just seem to be ignorant.
Bruce, I don't know what they are, but 8 months ago, if you'd have told me that once we have multiple companies with a valid vaccine, that so many Americans, and some of them highly educated, some of them in the medical community, see, I'm not going to take a shot. I would never, if you'd have told me that 8-9 months ago, there'd be so many people not interested in taking a shot, I wouldn't have believed you. We were just waiting for these vaccines to come out, and they did it in record time, and finally we started to get, and then I don't know if we're going to get to our 70% herd immunity, because there may be close to 30% that may not take any shot, and I don't think you're going to be able to force anybody to take a shot.
Darwin's going to take care of a bunch of people.
Darwin.
Well, back to the climate change a little. I guess you need to be wrapping this up. Is that?
We'll wrap up here pretty soon. Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested to see if you can bring us back to climate change.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go for it.
There has to be someone to take the lead. And I think as the situation gets worse, they'll be more receptive to change, to fighting the global climate change issues. And I think the United States needs to be a part of the leadership, just like they were during the ozone issues. And if we don't set the stage, and as voters, when you start to see Jody Ernst and Grassley, you might want to throw out that it is a real issue. And Grassley will believe it's an issue. He's afraid it's going to hurt the poor. And he doesn't want to deal with it from that standpoint. But I would say one of the things is get your economy working where it's not just a governmental issue. Let the pricing mechanism drive the change. And that goes back to the carbon pricing or cap and trade thing. Mm-hmm. I really believe you got to get the entire economy involved in it. So as a closing thing, I would say, think about pushing those two issues. One of those two. And I tend to favor the carbon tax because the cap and trade, I've been told, can be manipulated a little too much. I'm done for the evening. Did I bring it back?
That's pretty good. Yeah. And you know, as I was, you know, partly as I was hearing, kind of, you know, there is sort of this whole complex of issues that are, you know, the whether or not we should and how we can respond to them is so deeply partisan in our current kind of political landscape that there are pieces of, you know, just as Warren was describing, kind of who would have imagined that we would be where we are with vaccines kind of on both sides, and who would have imagined that 70 years ago, you know, that now we would have winters like we currently have, you know, where, you know, we probably, again, the average temperature has only come up so much, right? But the, you know, the warm days are real melty and the cold days are frigid, but, you know, they're confined to a week and then we move on, right? And I think too, part of the challenge, you know, that percentage that says, yes, climate change is real, but no, it's not going to affect us, is that some of these effects are kind of nice at this level, right? Like on some level, we don't miss those winters from 70 years ago, but we remember them and we can, you know, that fits right in with this understanding of how the climate is changing. And, you know, having snow on the ground from November through the end of March is really not, like, you know, that's for people in Minnesota to deal with. We don't really want to deal with that in Iowa, right? And so the fact that we are effectively living a state south of where we grew up is, you know, kind of nice a lot of the times. And we have air conditioning now, so that helps. So some of that is, you know, that calls for us as, you know, there is an us as voters portion of this to remember that even the things that are in the short run feeling better are also potentially problems. Some things that feel better are just better, right? But a lot of these effects that are long-term problems are actually kind of short-term kind of bonuses. Like, we don't have those winters from 70 years ago anymore. But now we have the summers that we have, and it's not actually a great trade-off because now we're outsourcing, you know, our climate control to Carrier rather than Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. So there are those pieces where, you know, I will let Kent be as specific as he wants to be on the, you know, things to talk to your legislators about, but particularly the legislators that you personally voted for and won, which are different legislators based on whichever box you are in the screen, right? But if you can say, hey, I voted for you and this is what you need to do, you know, that I voted for you does make a difference, if you can say it honestly. So, and this is, you know, this is stuff that I expect to see addressed in some meaningful way. And, you know, if we can agree on the problem, then we can start actually wrestling with the solutions. Mm-hmm.
So is that going to be part of the contemporary issues class that you are kind of formulating for the fall?
Well, we haven't sorted out exactly what's going to happen in the fall with contemporary issues. It'll most likely return to its regular time. It's Sunday morning time. And, you know, I think we could probably stand to have, you know, a handful of sessions from Kent to give us,
yes,
you know, some some deeper dive through this material.
Go, Kent, go.
And some of the, okay, you know, why is it that a tax would be better than cap and trade or, you know, whatever the case may be. But we'll have more other topics to talk about in the fall as well.
Well, I was really excited on Earth Day there. Of course, Greta Thunberg gets a lot of press for her worldwide tours and her enthusiasm, a continued enthusiasm for recognizing, admitting, if you use that word, and doing something about climate change. But there is a sort of a Greta Thunberg in Iowa, right in the Ankeny area. Her name is Lily Hill. She's in eighth grade and she is as exuberant and articulate as Greta. And wouldn't it be fun to have her come? You know, the Kent has, all the information and the logical, the way we have to tackle this politically and scientifically, but it would be fun just to bring in someone like that, that would just get people excited about it and just get, you know, coming from a youth, I just think it'd be a great example and make climate change and going for climate change a positive thing.
Well, thank you for that, Marilyn. I was not aware of her. So we may lean on you to get us in touch.
Okay.
Bev.
We also have a friend that's been Bruce's friend way, way, way longer than mine, who is a meteorologist. And I asked him a couple years ago, what's going on with this crazy weather and why is this happening? And he said, you know, it's a big pendulum. It swings this way and then it'll swing back and then it comes this way again. So there's one more thought for y'all to consider. That's all.
When you talk to Harvey again, mention to him that the physics basically pretty solid for climate change right now.
I will tell him.
And I'll talk to him. I get, as long as he's sober.
Yeah. Well, that's
I got to find a geologist that'd like to talk to him. It's
not the anymore. But if you're going to, you know, if you want to present that, it would be interesting to present his side as well. That's all I was kind of going for. So we can have like a little... you know, a little duke it out kind of thing there, Nathan. We could put up the ropes and I'll walk with the sign what round we're in. And
his name is Freeze.
Yeah.
And he partnered with a guy named Notice. So when they first came on the radio many years ago, they said, Freeze Notice. And everybody panicked. It's like, what?
Harvey Freeze and Charlie Notice. And they started at Iowa State in meteorology and were partners still. I mean, one's a little more retired than the other, but that's the story.
I went on a cruise with Harvey Freeze about 3 years ago.
Nice. Harvey and Marcia. Yeah. Yeah. They stood up at our wedding with Bruce. I had my side, he had his side.
Anyway, Nathan.
Oh.
And if I go against them, can I bring in my meteorologist from the University of Denver?
Sure. You
want to fly him in?
Yeah. I'm going against a pro. I want to bring a pro in.
Yeah. So, and, you know, addressing the fact that there are oscillations in the climate and that we are way off track from what those oscillations would otherwise have predicted. I think both of those are important pieces here.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.